Lancaster, you are listening to the Green Majority here at CIUT 89.5 FM in the lovely city of Toronto, which is lovely and gray this morning. However, we'll somehow find a way to get through that. I've got a couple of fun guests and then a maybe fun, maybe not fun. We'll see how it goes. A little debate with Kevin planned. I don't actually know what Kevin's position on this is, but we had some interaction with the listener right before the show today about the issue of animal rights and regarding one of the posts that I put up. And I thought it was something that inspired me that I'd like a little bigger of a format to sort of address rather than write an essay on the Facebook page. So hopefully you'll all be interested, but Bekenz will be dealing with the issue of animal rights. I'm always there's one of those things where I'm always a little bit nervous that somebody might get offended, but unfortunately, you know, you can't please everybody, so we'll just have to bear with it and do our best, and hopefully Kevin and I can have a fun discussion about that. Try and keep it as lighthearted as possible, because I know it's one of those things that people tend to get very excited about. That will be for when Kevin Farmer joins us after the first interview. However, our first interview will be with Barry Martin, who's the lead strategy and designer at Hypnotic. That is not why we're speaking to him today. However, we'll be speaking to him today as one of the co-organizers of the Brewer's Plate, which is the fifth annual local sustainable food and beer. Happens in spring here in Toronto, and is benefiting Toronto-based charity Green Thumbs Growing Kids. So we'll be talking to Barry in just a moment. Later in the program, of course, we'll also have another interview, which will be with Sandro De Clemente, which hopefully I said his name properly. But he was actually a listener of a different show here at CIUT, contacted their host recommending that he want to maybe talk about a topic. It was forwarded to me, and so we've started doing some really good resource sharing here at CIUT. So I'm going to have this guy on. It's Sandro, as I said, and we're going to talk a little bit about the technology of alternate fuel sources, specifically hydrogen, and just sort of what's happening with that. There was a lot of talk about the hydrogen fuel economy over the past few years. My personal assessment of that is that the hype on that has died down a little bit. We're definitely not hearing as much about it these days. It seems like that isn't the direction that car companies are going. I'm certainly not the be-all, end-all on what's happening in the secret labs over at all the major car companies. Perhaps we can get a comment on that in the future. But for now, we're going to talk to Sandro about maybe what some of the benefits and negatives of that technology are in general. That is mostly what we're going to be talking about today. And then also we're going to have all sorts of other fun stuff scattered throughout the show. I've got a few announcements to make today. So hopefully everybody's going to enjoy everything. I would like to get started. However, I do believe we have Barry on the line. Are you there, Barry?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. So before we get into Brewer's Plate, let's give people a little bit of a background for you. So you're the lead strategy and designer at Hypnotic. Do you want to just tell people exactly what that is?
Sure. Hypnotic is a design company. We make marketing communications for what we call values-driven brands. Basically, people doing good things.
Mm-hmm.
Those break down into nonprofits, sort of social entrepreneurs, and what we call social intrapreneurs, people who work at maybe bigger corporations or organizations, but sort of have the wherewithal to make something interesting happen.
Okay.
And, yeah, so...
Well, I think Brewer's Plate probably seems to qualify for that. You're promoting a local charity based on called Green Thumbs Growing Kids.
No, actually, Green Thumbs Growing Kids was last year.
Oh, was it? Or am I going from the wrong one here? Well, my apologies. So if you want to, maybe I may have ended up with the wrong press release in front of me then. Do you want to just explain how this year's going to work?
Yeah, so I'll tell you a few things. First of all, you're right. It does definitely hit a whole bunch of the departments that we care about. It's first of all supports local entrepreneurs, which we all know is a great way to keep money in local economies.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically focused on food and beverage, but in Ontario the food sector is huge, so that's a good thing. The second thing that it does is again, it's because of the kinds of businesses it's supporting, is promoting better practices around food and farming. And the third thing that really matters to us about this is that the money goes to this year a charity called Not Far From the Tree.
Mm, yes, of course.
You've heard of these guys?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we've had someone on from them before. Yeah.
Okay. Should I give you any kind?
Oh,
of...
Oh, sure. Yeah, please. If you want to just let the listeners know what they're doing as well.
Well, I mean, in short, they have a series of volunteers, too many even. Basically,
a rare problem in the not-for-profit charity sector. It's too many volunteers.
You'll see why people are really excited to be a part of it. But they collect fruit. They harvest fruit from the city, urban, you know, backyards, front yards, private property, public property, et cetera, and they divide what they take between the volunteers who pick that day, the people who own the property, and places that they donate it to. And so what the volunteers get, aside from, you know, feeding the hungry, this amazing fruit that would otherwise just turn into mulch on the ground, is fresh outdoor time, a little exercise, and a chance to, you know, connect with people, build some community. So that's why people love to do it.
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of those things I remember when I was growing up in my neighborhood. There was a lot of those the trees with the blackberries on them that would stain all the concrete all the way up and down the street. And I was, even as a kid, I was like, man, I wish somebody would do something with this. So it sounds like somebody is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they've had years where they've harvested like 20,000 pounds of fruit. It's astronomical.
Wow. And this is all, at this point, this is all from the city of Toronto?
This is all from the city of Toronto.
Wow. So let's take that and dial it back.
Sorry, when you say City of Toronto, you mean the GTA, right?
Yes, yeah. in the macro sense. So let's dial it back to sort of the theme of what exactly Brewer's Plate is. So you're sort of celebrating local food. There's definitely a local food aspect. These are all people who are local manufacturers and businesses. I see from, again, I believe I have last year's actually press release in front of me somehow. But some of the participants from last year were involved with things like the Big Carrot and Mill Street Organic Beer. Do you want to talk about some?
Yeah, so there's 25 local craft brewers to start, mm-hmm. right? So these are, members of a burgeoning craft beer movement in Ontario. We all kind of grew up in this beer era where you have this polarized kind of Molson Labatt thing going on, but thankfully in Ontario. As in a lot of places in the U.S. and Canada, but here it's just super strong. There's this movement growing of these hyper craft oriented entrepreneurs who make things that are actually delicious. So these people are motivated by making things that are interesting and dynamic and experimental or traditional, but like in a really rich sense. But not entirely motivated by trying to squeeze out the biggest bottom line they can at whatever expense. And so it's a pleasure supporting these kinds of people, and I really hope it grows. For one thing, because I've become a big beer fan over the last few years as people have introduced me to these things, and I've started to understand what it takes to make something delicious. But another, because again, they're all over the province, and if you stimulate these kinds of things, these are the people who hire people who work in their town. These are the people who buy from other people who make things around them. You know, we have all kinds of statistics that show what happens when small and medium-sized businesses are supported. They support many, 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 many more people than the kind of large or big box or chain organizations that, just kind of extract money from our local economies and put them in somebody else's pocket.
One of the interesting angles on that, actually, I was going to ask you another question, which I'll save for a minute from now, but you reminded me of something else that I remember hearing in class with regards to that issue that almost never gets brought up, but and I thought it was a really interesting perspective, which is the, we're getting into areas where one of our many, many environmental concerns these days is fresh water, and talking about big factory farms in impoverished countries and that sort of thing, and about how, most of what's in your food, like most people are aware of the fact that like lettuce, for instance, is, I don't know, like 99.9% water.
Mm-hmm.
But when you grow it, that water comes from the soil. So when you grow food in say, somewhere in Southern Africa or something, and then ship it to Europe, you're exporting, not just you're exporting a product with food that you can, exchange money for, but you're actually exporting their water.
A resource,
yeah.
Unequivocally. I've seen Maude Barlow from the Council of Canadians talk about this when we were trying to, put the brakes on the mega quarry just outside Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And, people don't realize it. These companies that are, canning, whether it's beer or water or whatever, around the world, are extracting that from people's ecosystems. And, it's part of a cycle that goes up and comes down, drains through, is filtered by the soil, ends up in their aquifers, and ends up coming back again to be used. And when we take it away and ship it somewhere else, that leaves their ecosystem.
So we've talked about a couple of the benefits. We've talked about the economic benefits, of course, for local food. The issue there, of course, being that there's also an associated theory that if you know your farmer, your food's going to be safer, which that is one of the sort of arguments that I'm not on board with. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean so, but I think there is definitely something for the aspect of that I do agree with is the aspect that when you're shopping for items in the store and your only connection to that food item is, say, Loblaws or whomever, Sobeys or whatever one of the kind of major stores is that if all your life all of your food comes from a supermarket, you have no concept of what goes into actually making food. And I think this is sort of part of the disconnect where people aren't aware of these issues and they frankly don't care in a lot of cases because they don't have any concept of, well, you know, tomatoes come from Loblaws, mm-hmm. not from a field.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on a whole bunch of issues there. You know, that system that you're talking about is part of a very, 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 very elaborate, fairy dust spraying, concept. Like, the idea is they're really, when you go into a grocery store or Loblaws, there are just a small handful of companies that actually own all of the brands that are in those on those shelves. And that's not just the packaged stuff. I mean, you know, but what is it? Four companies produce 85% of North America's meat.
Mm, actually, we post it occasionally. I like to repost it because I think it's a great graphic. But it's the graphic I believe you're referring to, and I've seen it. I've had it come up in some of my classes as well in the past, where they have all the kind of bubbles, and there's four main companies in the middle, and then that splits down to sub companies. Mm-hmm. And so there's things that people think of as brands that are just, and they don't realize they're actually subsidiaries, right? Yeah. Like Kraft is a subsidiary of something else, mm-hmm. and all these cases. And I think when you just look at that graphic, you really go, wow, I'm really buying everything I consume from like four companies.
Yeah, there are these multinationals that are really, for them, brands are just pawns on a large chessboard. And they're doing everything that they possibly can to create margins at any expense, whether it's externalized, somebody's being treated horribly somewhere else and not being paid, somebody's they're destroying the environment somewhere else and turning it into something, or whether it's just that they're creating the perception that you are incapable, you can't cook, you're incompetent, you have how modern marketing works, create a fear or create some sort of inequity, and maybe there's a market for it. So all of those things are, really glossy packaging. So the theory behind shopping from a farmer or knowing the producers is you can look them in the eye, you can ask them what their practices are. You can learn a little bit about what it takes to put things in food that you'd want there. You can use, if you don't want to, go to the trouble of that, or you can also use shorthand like, do you know about Local Food Plus?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great certification because it covers, five, six things that you'd really want people to be thinking about if you knew about them. How the soil is treated, how the laborers are treated, what exactly goes into the food. It's not strictly organic, but it pays attention to current research and uses third-party experts to vet. So there are people who are paying attention to these things, I don't want to give Loblaws a hard time, just using them as a euphemism for large grocery chains.
Oh, it's kind of like Kleenex, right? It's a brand, but everybody just uses it as a shorthand. Yeah.
But these stores are basically, they're part of a large, matrix that they're trying to keep people asleep in, so that we just go to the store and think, it's bright, it's shiny, and look at all the choice we have, when that's really not the case.
Yeah, well, and I think it comes down to there's a sticky aspect that I like to emphasize whenever we get into corporation bashing, that it's not that nobody that's saying corporations shouldn't be trusted or in general you should be wary of corporations is not saying that
I'm a corporation.
I mean, that's one example, but thinking of multinationals and stuff like that and things like Kraft, mm-hmm. Is that not that you're not making an accusation that the individual executives are all evil and they're all trying to trick you. It's that which also doesn't mean that none of them are, but it just means that corporations are set up the way that corporations are set up. They are essentially amoralistic, not immoral, but amoralistic machines that are designed to create profit. And when you look at it from that sort of an angle about, well, this is just a system that's set up with incentives, and those incentives are maximizing profit, and profit is not linked to health or nutrition or any of those other things,
or to community development, or to anything even long-term beneficial to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a... Do you know about B Corporations?
No, actually, no.
So you might want to look this up because this is a counterpoint to exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. There's a certification by a nonprofit called B Lab in the U.S. called B Corporation. My company, Hypnotic, is a B Corporation, and there are some 50 plus in Canada, 700 or so in the U.S. And these are corporations who are what's called purpose-driven. The idea is that they're ultimately working on something that's even bigger than their own bottom line, and so they can make long-term decisions. You know, they can say, it's not about squeezing out quarterly profits, shareholder returns. It's about making this thing sort of a golden goose that gives back forever. And that may mean I invest in my community. That may mean I invest in the local environment. At the sort of giant brand names, you know, level, you can, the players are people you might imagine, Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, Method Brand, you know, the great beautifully designed packaging. Mm-hmm. And then there are tons of small organizations as well who have elected to apply for the certification. And in the U.S., I think there are some 17 states or something, maybe 13 states and another 17 in the pipeline that have adopted legislation to support these kinds of corporations.
Mm. Oh, very, no, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think you'll...
We actually had an interview with Patagonia about 4 months ago, I think. So mm-hmm. if anybody's interested, I believe it made it on the cut on the new website. So if people are interested, maybe I'll try and find a link to that interview and put it on this week's show as well. But I think we could probably talk for hours on mm-hmm. On this, you know, the incentive process of corporation. I'd like to let people know a little bit more about exactly your solution, which is not the solution, of course, but a place where people can sort of meet and learn about this and also enjoy some fine local beer and food. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about exactly what's happening this
yes.
year?
Yes. So the Brewer's Plate is this year in the gorgeous CBC atrium on April 17th. There are, like I said, 25 craft brewers taking place. One of the things I love about it, is it's the kind of, food and beverage event where you can actually stop and talk to people, right? This guy's pouring your beer, or this woman pouring your beer is probably, the owner of the place, or somebody who actually, you know, works on crafting the product. And they're all about talking to you about what's in it, why it's special, et cetera. So it's really informative and fun, et cetera. It's not like you're getting into some big line and you're going to be jostled before you get a bite.
Sure.
Then there are at least 12 chefs, and some of those people, who's there this year?
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you've got Chef Stefan Howard is on that list.
Yep. Yeah,
yeah, so he's the executive chef at my actual job, so I know him quite well.
Oh, that's hysterical. We have also partnerships with some schools there. We also have artisans will be there. I know. I think Choco Soul will be doing. I hope they're doing their beer floats again.
Oh, that sounds great.
Do you know these guys, Choco Soul?
I haven't heard of them. No.
Oh my goodness! Well, they're another one who's up your alley. Kind of a social enterprise, but basically a bicycle-powered chocolate company. They have a horizontal trading relationship with farmers in Oaxaca, Mexico, mm-hmm. and so they bring in directly their cacao beans, process them here into you know, the more the originally traditional sense of chocolate. It's much more of like a superfood. It doesn't have any, you know, garbage in it that you wouldn't want to eat. That's the pure ingredients. They'll put in, you know, vanilla or coconut or things to sweeten it, but nothing, you know, there are no strange chemicals on it you can't read.
So what, like, we talked a little bit about some of the reasons why the issues that that this event deals with are important, and you've told us a little bit about who's going to be there. What do you hope people will get out of it? What is your pitch to get people to actually come down? They're going to have some great food, and what do you hope that they
experience?
Well, here's
the thing. You know, the stuff that you talk about on your show, it is in danger of being sort of kept in a microcosm, mm-hmm. right? Like there are people who are aware of these things, and they're, you know, game to talk to you about the stuff for hours. Mm. As a marketer, I know that people are really busy and doing their best to filter out new messages, even ones that are, you know, important, because there are all kinds of important ones. Some people are dealing with cancer. Some people are just rushing everywhere trying to get their kids around. Some people are under stress from their job. We're all really busy. Events like this, I think, are critical, accessible gateways to the issues. It's amazingly innocuous. It's fun. You come. It's convivial. You get to enjoy the best ingredients, lovingly crafted by professionals and in the company of enthusiasts, and taste these things as well. And all of a sudden, you know, you're talking to people, you're finding out what it takes to deliver these things, and you start to get some insight into the challenges that they face, and you start to realize, well, why can't I have this all the time? Why shouldn't tomatoes taste like this all the time? Why have I been buying beer from the beer store when it's owned by, you know, this multinational, not even Canadian? I mean, I thought it was a government, an Ontario government store. It looks so crummy. Sorry.
No, actually, I bumped into somebody at a hostel recently. It was from Czechoslovakia and was telling me, yeah, I tried some of your local beer. It's okay, but you should try the Czech stuff. And so I said, you know, partially offended, but I wanted to keep my cool. I said, so what did you try? He's like, well, I had Molson Canadian and export. I was like, no. That's not Canadian beer. It's just called Canadian beer.
You know, any more than most of the Pilsner that that they're shipping, you know, is the authentic Czech Pilsner anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. I remember years ago, I forget what it was, there's a common beer where there's a big kerfuffle because they were being sold out to another a company in another country, and they lost, like, massive amounts of share just because the company mm-hmm. was moving out of their country.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting, because I've poked around as you get hooked on these things and you start to learn about them, do your research, it's really interesting to see the conversations. You know, NPR put out an infographic like 3 weeks ago that showed the 200 plus, 300, you know, world's most prominent beer brands that are actually owned by one of the two big beer companies.
Ah, wow.
And it was really interesting to see the conversations, because these are serious beer aficionados, people who really, you know, they follow a brewery just for one special batch, and they try to get their hands on it, and they trade them and stuff. And what they were saying was, oh, it's such a shame about this brewery, you know, they have integrity. I know that they got, you know, where they got to because of their care for craft. I really hope they're not, you know, forced to change their process, use cheaper ingredients, use less of these things, or water it down, you know. And people still want to support their local beer. Even when, you know, after it gets bought up by a multinational. In our case here, it kind of goes against what we're working on. This is as much about supporting and sustaining local economies as it is about getting people to appreciate what it takes to grow better ingredients and to think about what they're eating, where it comes from, et cetera. So, you know, when a small microbrewery does get bought up by a multinational, even if they're not changing their practices right away, they are... in spite of the fact that they're providing a few jobs, technically funneling that money out of our economy.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about, you said what you hope for people is to provide like an atmosphere where people can talk about it. I think
an entry point, an accessible gateway. Yeah.
And I think, well, that's one of the key things that I've found is that just in my experience, you can't change someone's mind whose mind isn't ready to be changed. And I think that's what keeps a lot of people away from the environmental issues. It sounds very complicated. I don't know, you know, my opinion is what for certain. And I have a lot of people who sound very certain telling me things. But it can be very disorienting and just put people off the entire subject. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not ready to get a second job to learn about all the things they need to have an expert opinion on all these things, and so the reaction, I think, quite understandably, is just to ignore it. So, do you feel like this is a good way to kind of ease people in? You don't have people standing by the door telling them what they must feel about.
That's it. There are no pamphlets being handed out, etc. And just like you pointed out earlier with corporations, you know, it's not like anybody who works for any corporation would kick a dog right on the way home.
We hope not, anyway.
Right? You know, I mean, obviously, there's always a few, but
statistically speaking,
right. And so, we most of us, I think, feel like the system is the way it is, right? Things have started to happen the way they have over the last 50 years, in this really, really slow drip, and now we just live in this mindset that the economy, and specifically a growth-driven economy, is pretty much everything. And so, that's such a massive conversation to start with people that, of course, they're not going to want to, you know, it's polarizing and it's just too much to ramp up around. Have a beer made by somebody who's really enthusiastic about it, who really loves it, who you can believe has done their best to procure the best ingredients. I mean, it's in their eyes, right? Share a plate from a chef who's, you know, spent all this time training in the, you know, nobody has any ideas about the glamours of working in the kitchen. It's a tough job at the best of times. And here they are handing you this plate of something they've lovingly crafted that you just couldn't make at home. It's going to be succulent and delectable. It's going to be, and they're going to give you a solid amount. You can walk around all evening and chat with people. I can't think of a more accessible place for you to stop and realize, wow, what would it take to get more of this?
Well, I think that's a hell of a pitch, Barry. It's been a pleasure having you on the air, although we are unfortunately out of time. Barry Martin is, of course, today talking about Brewer's Plate Toronto, which can be found at brewersplatetoronto.org, which you said was April 17th. Do you have a final message, and or would you like to let people know how they can get tickets?
Actually, you can get tickets right through the website, and that's probably the best way to do it. The venue is a gorgeous one, the CBC Atrium. It probably, I couldn't think of a better time to get your head around new, amazing, gorgeous craft beers than sort of the dawn of spring.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Barry.
Likewise.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye. So we're going to go to a music break here for just a minute or two. We'll be back to talk to Kevin Farmer. And then right at the end of the show, of course, we'll still have Sandro De Clemente to talk about hydrogen fuel cells. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
By the sea, it's not much, but it's just enough to see. It's always changing and it's changing me, whoa. It's always changing and it's changing me, whoa. Whoa. And I felt the wind take me from my feet. It's nowhere, how I want to be. It's always pushing and it's pushing. Pushing and it's pushing me, whoa. I tried find a little hope, a little light of mine. It's always holding and it's holding tight, whoa. Always holding and it's holding tight, holding tight. But I can be a friend and I know it's right. Go on, baby, push it in the dead of night. Guts like a knife, guts like a knife, guts like a knife, guts like a knife.
All right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I hope you enjoyed our little talk with Barry Martin. As I said, I know some of the folks who are taking part in the Brewer's Plate. Somebody I work with is one of the chefs that will be presenting, so I'm certain the food will be excellent. It always is when he makes me snacks at work. So we've got Kevin on the line. Kevin, I wanted to chat with you just a little bit about something that happened this morning, and then we may come back to it a little bit later in the show because I don't want to keep Sandra waiting too long. But it was on the only issue where we posted a video, and this is all on the this all happened on the Facebook wall there, so you can go and check our Facebook page if you're interested in seeing what's happening or joining the conversation. If you'd like to respond at all to my comments or to anyone else's comments, it is a open forum, so please do feel to feel free to participate with that. But essentially, what had happened was I put up a video, and it was Rick Mercer talking about something, and it had to do with it was something I'd seen in the past, and so I just sort of reposted it because I remembered watching it and liking it, but I didn't actually even rewatch it this time. But it was care of the Sierra Club, and somebody is apparently not a fan. It was the next comment down. So I just asked them why, and I was forwarded to a Animal Liberation Front website. And having to do with, it was basically an outline article from one of their authors talking about tips to keep in mind on which organizations to support. Now, Kevin, I know I asked you to take a look at this as well. Maybe before I get into my thoughts on it, you want to tell me what yours was? Because I'm not entirely sure that we'll have 100% the same opinion on this for once. It doesn't happen very often, but why don't you tell me what your reaction was?
Well, so this is an interesting issue that comes up in environmental studies and environmental policy, and it's an attempt. Essentially, it boils down to an attempt to give some part of the environment, in this case, animals, some sort of standing in the courts. Right, like right now. Nature has no standing before the courts. It has no legal recognition. No one is there to look after its interests. We don't even put a value on, say, a functioning forest unless we cut it down and turn it into timber.
With the exception of Bolivia, if I may be getting the country wrong, but there was somebody that recently put it into law that that nature had an inherent right, but certainly not a large degree.
Okay. Yeah, well, certainly, if that's true, that's news to me.
I could also just be completely wrong. I'll have to double check. Tell you what, if I can find it, I'll put it on the show's post. Anyway, however, continue.
So in this sense, what we've got is the issue where if someone has, like, say, the easiest example would be environmental tourism, and if you are an environmental tourist destination, then if you're an environmental tourist destination, then you have the ability to protect the ecosystems that are, you know, drawing tourists into your location. So you can go before the courts and say, look, my interests are being damaged by this threat to the environment. Same thing with, say, whale watching. You know, people could say, look, a threat to the whales is a threat to my business. And so it boils down to then, sometimes people have a vested interest in protecting animal life because they want to hunt it. And this is the case with, say, an organization like Ducks Unlimited, which is essentially people saving wetlands so that they can continue to hunt ducks, but they have a superb record of preserving wetlands.
Mm.
And in Britain, it was the anglers who got the factories to stop dumping pollution into all of the rivers in England. In England, I forget the city, or it might have been countrywide, but pollution laws clamped down on the dumping of waste into waterways because the anglers banded together and they were sort of recognized as having rights. So it's part of the comment that ended up on the Facebook wall is sort of a larger it's part of a larger issue that essentially tries to use the market as it exists today and tries to apply sort of market levers to pulls on existing market levers.
Mm-hmm.
to address issues of to address environmental issues and it's by no means a settled issue.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't want to keep Sandra waiting too long. I'm going to come back to this after Sandra, and we'll have another couple comments. But just sort of to stick what my perspective on you know, I had said to the person on there, and you can go and read the comments. They're all on the public wall on the Facebook page. But what I'd basically said to the person was, hold on, let me address it on air because I don't want to end up spending a whole bunch of time writing something out. I think I could say faster. But essentially, what my objection to the post was that not that I disagree at all with the idea of the fact that we shouldn't be killing animals. I'm someone who's in the process, what's been a several year process of cutting down to the eventual intended elimination of meat products from my diet. It's something that for just accessibility issues I find difficult, you know, as a relation to my budget and things like that, right? And I think there's what my objection was the idea of the use of if you're not 100% with us and in complete agreement with everything that we would like to do, not just with the fact that you agree that this is an issue, but that you need to agree with our very strict way of what the right way to deal with it is, then you're automatically pro the everyone who's completely the opposite. And so by saying that, you know, if you're not completely in line with ALF's ideas, and not only their ideas and their moral values, but how they will want to deal with the issue and what they think the appropriate response to that is, then you're the enemy. I think is one of the biggest failings in any environmental movement or any movement at all, where you've basically got a bunch of people who don't already agree with you, and the groups of people seem to think that the best way to change people's minds is to clobber them overhead with a stick. And call them the enemy if they don't change their minds. And I just, as someone who's sort of, I'm more interested in, and that's sort of why we come to the angle of the show, is I would rather share information and let's change people's minds by discourse. And if you have a disagreement, let's talk about it. And that's why I was actually really happy that this person posted it on the wall, because I think it's something that definitely deserves to be talked about. But I personally, again, not representing the show itself, but my personal opinion is that I don't think like that attitude has or will ever change anybody's mind. And I think it's a self-defeating strategy, because not only is it not going to be effective on most people. I'm sure some people will be convinced by it, but I think most people will simply solidify their not caring about this issue, because it serves to prevent people. It's like, well, you know, I either have my own opinion or I completely adopt someone else's opinions, and I don't, you know, I either haven't thought about it enough to feel that strongly about it, or, you know, I minorly disagree or I majorly disagree. I just don't find it productive. It's not that I have any problem with their sort of values and moral judgments. But I have to say I strongly disagree with the tactics. That's all.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of a separate discussion about the nature of what we tend to call "quote unquote" the environmental movement, which is you know, often portrayed in media and certainly portrayed by the Harper government as a monolithic entity that's fully coordinated.
And I'll tell you, Kevin, I wish it was.
Yeah, exactly.
I really wish it was, but it isn't.
I wish it were as well, and it's been one of my longstanding complaints that, sort of like what you've already said, is that you'll have all of these various entities representing a certain piece of the puzzle that don't coordinate or don't even like each other because they don't completely share an ideology.
And so
it tends to come up most, in my personal experience, it does tend to come up mostly around the issue of animal rights.
Yeah, and I mean, and there's a few other things, and I'd like to, again, I want to make sure we get to Sandra and maybe have some time to come back to this, or well, definitely, I'm certainly not afraid of sort of talking about this issue. I just think it's something where, you know, I need a specific thing to talk about, because, you know, nobody wants to listen to me rant on for an entire hour with my own personal opinions, so, but I think it was worth mentioning just on the fact that, you know, one of the reasons why, quote-unquote, and I'm using these in very, very loose terms, and we're going to get right to Sandra right after this, but in very, very sort of loose, generalized, you know, for the sake of time only descriptions of quote-unquote right versus quote-unquote left is, you know, part of the reason why on issue by issue a lot of people, you know, will, you know, agree with the ideas of animal rights. They'll agree with, you know, generally. That doesn't mean they'll act in a way that people who feel strongly about that issue would think are, you know, reflect those values, but people will purport them. But it's this divisiveness of the sort of progressive side of things where everybody has an issue that's the most important to them. I'm super interested in energy and transportation. I know, Kevin, that you're super interested in biology and like we like to talk about life in the oceans. But that doesn't, you know, you preferring to say to talk about, you know, if we had two stories and the story I wanted to talk about was a new kind of, you know, car system or solar powered cars, and the story you wanted to talk about was about lead poisoning in fish. It doesn't mean that we have to hate each other because we haven't agreed on what the most important story that week is.
Right.
And I think that's just, you know, it's not only is it counterproductive, it's the divide and conquer techniques of the other side. And I'm not accusing them of inspiring this sort of like intergroup hatred of some sort of subgroups. But, you know, when we're on 98%, when there's a group of us that are 98% on the same side and all of us disagree in overlapping various sections on that on the final 2%, the people who are moving in lockstep win. And do you really, is it really worth it? And this is just the question I would ask to this person and to everybody else. Is it really worth it to hate each other over a 2% disagreement when that means we're giving up the 98%? We're giving up the fight and the unity and the strength and the joint unity of fighting with strength on the other 98% that we do agree with. Are you really going to give that 98% up for the 2% of your personal pet issue? I just don't understand it. Anyway, that's my rant for the day. Kevin, I'll get your response maybe when we come back. I don't want to leave Sander waiting any longer. But please, if this is something that's important to you, or if you like something I said today, or you like something Kevin said, or you disagree with any of it, please do use the resource. There's already a nice thread started on the website. Feel free to join in. As long as everybody stays nice and polite and respectful, that would be absolutely fantastic. But anyway, so we'll move on. But thank you, Kevin, and hopefully we'll have time to talk to you a bit later. So now we're going to go to Sandra. Do I have you on the phone now, Sandra?
Yes, hi. Good morning, Darren.
I apologize for keeping you.
No, my pleasure. Very interesting things to you said. Very interesting to me, of course. Fantastic. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I do have to whip out my soapbox every once in a while. You know, I try not to, but it's absolutely unbearable to keep it inside and all the time. So
you have to let it out.
Well, just trying to be a peacekeeper here. You know, I think that's one of the things. But we're not going to talking about animal rights with you anyway today. We're going to want to talk about hydrogen and with its relation to combustion engines. Now, this was something you contacted another show here at CIUT about, and they
yes.
forwarded you to me. And I was interested in your kind of proposal about what you wanted to talk about. But perhaps you have some benefits here that you've outlined as far as hydrogen fuel cells and hydrogen gas injection type technology. One of the things that I mentioned earlier was that this is something where I feel like it was making a lot of noise in the car companies and the tech industry a few years ago, and it seems to have died off. Would you agree with that? Is this still an up-and-coming technology, or have the powers that be somewhat abandoned it, at least for now?
Well, I think I've been following a lot about the fuel cell technology, and to my understanding, they've done things with trials on public transit buses. This particular technology actually is dealing more in the transport truck business, because obviously transport trucks deliver our groceries, building materials, concrete, and all those other things in our lives. We depend on it so much. So this was particularly targeted at this company developed over the past decade a unit that can produce from distilled water hydrogen gas, a small amount, and that hydrogen gas is brought into the engine of the truck. And it helps it burn the fuel more efficiently or more completely. And by doing that, the truck gets a little bit more power, and it also cleans up the environment. Diesel fuel is a matter of it's an oil. So obviously, from oil you get soot and all sorts of pollution. So this is a completely different technology altogether than the fuel cell. And this company has FedEx as one of its customers already, because they couldn't deliver products in California, but due to the emission standards that are so high. So this has worked great for them to allow them to go into the state of California and do the deliveries and pickups.
So has this technology been, so it hasn't been outright required in any areas. Is it part of the reason why we haven't seen that much penetration into the auto market, though? Is it because it's sort of only affordable or effective on certain types of vehicles, or is this simply a marketing issue? Why don't we see, if it's so effective, why don't we see it all over the place?
Well, one of the big things is this particular, of course, this basically the truck has a small unit on it, a system. It takes distilled water, it electrocutes it to create the hydrogen gas. Now, with water, as you know, we live in Canada. In wintertime, water freezes. In hot climates, because you're also electrocuting the water, if you have excessive heat, the water overboils. So to develop that technology to control the water temperature, it seems to be ridiculously expensive. Now, these units cost on average about $15,000, but it's a small expense when you think that large trucks only get about 4 to 6 miles per gallon, and
wow.
they consume
That's
on average per month.
Number.
It is very low. It is very awful, where a pickup truck does around 20 miles per gallon, and cars that are very efficient get around 30 miles per gallon. So trucks are very bad because you consider that they are pulling a load. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is, again, I think the cost is a big factor here. So for now, the technology has been developed. It's perfected. It works, but it has a very high cost factor due to all the things you need to not just electrocute the water, keep it from freezing, keeping it from overboiling, and all that.
So would you just go through, you gave me a list here of six benefits of the technology, if you want to just overview them for the listeners.
Yeah, of course. Well, the number one thing, of course, is, if you look at it from an environmental standpoint, because diesel fuel is an oil, and oil creates a lot of soot and particulate debris, it goes in there while it's reducing the soot because it's causing the oil to completely burn. It's also going to be, as a byproduct, it's also going to be giving the truck more power. And also the trucks, as they are already, they have emission devices on them to control the pollution that they're making. And these emission devices also get clogged with the soot and the carbon buildup. So by removing it at the source, it's going to keep the maintenance costs down. And, of course, the other benefit is, again, the trucks, on average, they've said, a minimum, the company guarantees 10% fuel savings. But they found through all the customers they have that they're doing between 15% and 20%. So if you think about it, if they go further every month or pay $1,000 less on fuel, after about a year and a half, they've paid off the unit, and the rest of the 9 years is all gravy.
Unfortunately, Sandra, we've got a minor technical error. I'm actually going to have the technician call you back.
Oh.
So if you want to pause there for a second, we'll get you right back on the line. But folks, we're just going to take a really, really short music break while we switch phones here. So just bear with us, and we'll be right back in like 30 seconds with Sandra.
Whatever happened to all the love? Something's coming down from up above.
All right, and we're back. Sorry about that. Sandra,
oh,
do
no
I have
problem.
You back on the line?
It's only technology.
There we go.
It.
It's only good when it works, you know.
Yeah, good when it works rather than it doesn't.
So sorry to interrupt you. If you want to go back, we were just talking about some of the benefits of this technology in general and what some of the opportunities for the future might be.
Well, I guess, again, the benefits was fuel savings, which then justify the unit. Of course, the engine runs a lot cleaner. Instead of having residual oil that didn't get burnt fully, it's causing the fuel to burn completely and therefore eliminating the emissions, greenhouse gases, the soot, and the carbon, which means the truck can go longer on the oil. The biggest polluter of engine oil is the soot and all the byproducts of combustion that go down into the engine oil. So that's the benefits as well. Trucks have a lot of emission controls on it that are getting clogged by the soot and the carbon buildup. So by eliminating the soot at the source where the combustion is happening, therefore it's going to allow for the emission control devices to have a longer life before replacement.
Now, one of the things that I've been aware of when we're talking about, as I was mentioning earlier and I've mentioned a few times on the show, one of the things I'm particularly, my specific interest is alternative energy and transportation. So one of the things I've been aware of is that a lot of the time companies will hesitate, especially big companies like auto manufacturers will sort of hesitate or have to guess about future technology because they don't know how the market's going to react. So when we had just sort of, the only thing out there was the combustion engine and kind of traditional gas engine, then it was simply a matter of you know, improving this technology and making refinements and making it stronger or more efficient based on market indicators. But they were essentially working with the same technology. The push for drastic fuel economy increases and or concern about the environment, which I wouldn't necessarily group in the same group of motivators,
yeah.
two separate things, has resulted in a lot of innovation. But we're at a point where there hasn't sort of been a clear winner. So we've got, if you look on the roads today, I've noticed a couple here in Toronto TTC buses that say hydrogen on the side. I've seen a few smaller vehicles that have things about, you know, biofuel capable and 97% ethanol capable and hybrids. There's full electric.
Mm-hmm.
We've got all these technologies. So with respect to the hydrogen, is this something that would apply to any type of engine, or is this going to, is this sort of a path? So what I'm asking essentially is, you know, is this gas plus hydrogen leads to full hydrogen eventually path, or can, as opposed to pursuing hybrids and thereby leading to full electric, or is this a technology that can sort of be applied widely to wherever the industry goes?
Well, I think, I mean, to your point, I mean, we already have electric cars, and the problem with electric cars, they don't have the range, so they put a smaller gas engine to charge the battery, because otherwise all electric cars wouldn't be able to go 400 kilometers on a charge. This technology can run on its own as an aid to current combustion engines to improve the efficiency, to improve the power. The only thing, I guess, what's holding it back is, I guess, I mean, of course, hydrogen gas is explosive, as we know. So do you want to have a tank of hydrogen gas in the back of your trunk powering your car? That would be an interesting question. But, I mean, in this particular unit, it produces such controlled amounts of hydrogen. It doesn't store it. It just makes it as it's used and then it's done. So it is a standalone unit. But, again, what seems to add to the cost, and automakers, I think, on the whole, are fairly, they try to cut costs as much as possible on their cars, that, you know, how do you keep it from freezing? How do you keep it from boiling over? What happens when the water, distilled water, gets low and you have to top it up? So those are a few of the constraints, I think, as it has in terms of using it in an automotive car application at this time.
So perhaps for the car enthusiasts, I don't know if Ari Rabinovich, occasional show helpers, previous volunteer show helpers, is the gentleman who came with me to the International Auto Show this year. So for those folks, that maybe what we're getting at here is that maybe don't hold out for your next vehicle for a full hydrogen or hydrogen, you know, personal vehicle at the moment, but maybe this is something that, due to the increased cost, maybe has to filter its way down through the transportation industry first. To allow the sales to sort of generate revenue enough that they can that these models end up getting refined and become cheaper.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I would also say for a car, since the car engine is so much smaller than the truck engine, maybe instead of having a unit that electrocutes the water, because that seems to be where all the cost is keeping the water at a certain temperature and keeping it from freezing. What about getting my personal thoughts on this is, if we could use a system on a car so that you just have a small little screw-in bottle, like, I don't know if you know the propane you buy to do plumbing at home, a small little canister. Mm-hmm. If you could buy one of those, screw it into your car, and it lasts 2 months, that would be, I think, doable, and you could buy it at Canadian Tire.
And I've seen some, and the issue around hydrogen storage tanks and why they moved into the electrolysis of, to generate hydrogen was the problem of storing it and tank size and stuff like that. So I also, and this is a couple years out of date, but I remember seeing a lot of research around Swiss cheese type micro materials, materials that increase surface area inside the tanks by essentially creating, like, you know, the inside, like a very micro version of like Swiss cheese, to give it more places so that they could cram kind of more hydrogen. So there's a variety of ways to attack this problem. It sounds, from what you've heard, though, is the electrolysis angle more what is being used these days, as opposed to the compressed tanks?
Well, in the large trucks, it is, I guess, due to the nature of the volume of hydrogen that the truck needs. It's easier to produce it from electrocuting the water. Again, they can put a big tank of water without any issue, rather than putting a huge tank of hydrogen gas, which is explosive, as we all know, in large quantities.
Mm-hmm. Hindenburg, so, anyone, in case they missed that.
Yeah. So in this case, I think for trucks, this is probably the best way to go. It would be good to see the price point start to come down on this. But obviously, a lot of research and development over the past decade that this company's put into getting it to work well is great. I think when they first started out, they didn't have any way of keeping the water from freezing. So for 6 months, it didn't work because it was frozen. And then in the summertime, you got 6 months use out of it, and 6 months you didn't because it froze. So now they've had to build extra technology and systems to keep the water from freezing.
Now, we've got only a couple of minutes here left, so I've got a little bit of a thoughtful question here. I'm not trying to bait you into a specific answer. I'm not even sure what my answer is on this, but it's maybe some food for thought here right before we have to go.
Okay.
What do you think of the idea that, you know, we talk a lot about in this program about climate change, and there's a lot of the reasons to, you know, reduce carbon emissions and stuff like that. A lot of the numbers that we're hearing now is that we have things like, you know, 10 years to make a major change, 6 years to make a major change, 14 years to make a major change. Is what do you think of the idea that you know, instead of trying to clean cars, we really need all the energy, all the movement, all the innovation needs to be moving away from fuel-based things at all? The argument for full electric or nothing, you know, invest in electric and elect in public transportation, or even better yet, just only invest in research for really well-defined public transportation systems so that we don't need the vehicles, because, you know, it's as opposed to creating a Band-Aid, just, you know, fixing the problem, that the hydrogen being somewhat of like a cleaning up the fuel as a Band-Aid solution, when really what we need to be doing is eliminating fuel, or maybe even eliminating, you know, the prevalence of personal transportation altogether. What do you think about that?
I think that's a fantastic idea. It sounds like the gasoline engine, combustion engine, has been around for decades and decades. We just seem to be trying to optimize it and optimize it and optimize it. I mean, really, the cleanest source is, of course, as you probably know, is probably using propane or even natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
That burns clean. It's very clean, good for the environment. But again, that using a compressed gas in wintertime has issues because the gas from being a gas turns into liquid, and it has a hard time starting. So I know that that's always been a challenge, but maybe solar is the way to go if we had enough sun. I totally agree with you. If there was another way of doing it, and again, or some of these fuel cells, but I've heard, you know, the popularity hasn't been going anywhere on those lately. Again, due to the cost of, you know, once you make millions of them, the cost goes down, but if you're only making a few thousand of them, the cost is so high.
In something where you know, you're trying to develop innovation, you know, governments doing things like using policy to, quote unquote, they say in the business world, pick the winners, is a bad strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But and I would agree with that. I think that, you know, all the as a in addition to everything else, I'm also an armchair science history enthusiast. And one of the things that I'm aware of is that some of the most revolutionary, some of the biggest ideas that have ever changed the world, all came from pure interest-based exploration, not government or corporation-funded research.
Mm-hmm.
The most world-changing, earth-shattering discoveries have almost exclusively been made by people doing things just because they were interested, and they did it in the free time, or they, you know, they did it. There was no paycheck that they were looking for at the end of the day. And those are the folks that changed the world. So I'm sort of sympathetic to the idea that it really excites me to see so many different types of technologies and stuff coming out. Mm-hmm. But the only thing at the end of that comes back is, man, if we only had 200 years to see how this played out. But unfortunately, we don't. We've got like 5.
Yes.
So yes. I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence. Like, I get excited and then I get disappointed, kind of all at the same time when I hear about this sort of thing.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you read about it, but I mean, apparently a long time ago, somebody made a great battery that would do a fantastic job of, you know, having a car go 400 or 500 kilometers, and the petroleum companies bought it and put it on the shelf because it's a threat to the petroleum industry. So
yep.
Since you're talking politics, there are also other issues that if you come out with this great supercar that doesn't use gasoline, you're going to have a price on your head.
Well, I think the moral of today's show, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you,
Sandro,
for having me.
Di Clemente.
Thank you.
I was worried I butchered your last name, did I say?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
That's very good, actually. I've had worse.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I think today's unofficial theme was let's all look at the big picture.
You know, very well
I think too many issues when viewed in isolation, I think, lose perspective. And hopefully today was thought provoking for everybody. At least some of the point was. I also I'm really hoping to try and get down to the Brewers Plate, Toronto. Sandra, if you've got free time, you should come and join me down there. But that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much. You've been listening to The Green Majority. Make sure you check out our website, greenmajority.ca. You can also look us up on Facebook and Twitter. Feel free to send me an email. I will respond to absolutely everyone until I run out of time. So please feel free to leave comments or email us if you're interested. Other than that, have a great week, and we'll be right back next week.